You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
President Obama granted clemency to 231 individuals yesterday, the most acts of clemency granted in a single day by any president. Altogether, the president has now commuted the sentences of 1,176 individuals, including 395 life sentences. He says he was acting on his belief that America is a nation of second chances, and according to a new report by the Brennan Center for Justice called Unnecessarily Incarcerated, he could safely go much further. Lauren Brooke Eisen, the report's lead researcher, found that an estimated 39% of the total prison population could be released with little to no risk to public safety, and she joins us now to explain. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Are we talking about 39% of everyone who's incarcerated in the federal, state, and local levels?
We're talking about the almost 1.5 million state and federal prisoners. So that's everyone who's in a state prison or in the federal prison system. And you're absolutely right. We studied the number of people who are incarcerated in state and federal prison, and we looked at all of their crimes. In fact, we looked at 370 different crime categories to estimate how many people are currently incarcerated without a sufficient public safety rationale. And we found that almost 40% of those people in state and federal prison are incarcerated with little public safety reason.
You used to be an assistant DA, and you prosecuted misdemeanors and felonies. Did you feel that way at that time?
Well, when you are a district attorney, you don't have that many options because the law is the law, right? But what DA does have is prosecutorial discretion. And our report recommends that district attorneys should take the recommendations and findings of this report and use their prosecutorial discretion to suggest alternatives to incarceration in a lot of these situations. And our report specifically suggests that about 25% of inmates right now, so if you took a snapshot of the state and federal prison population today, that about 25% of current inmates could have received some sort of alternative to incarceration, like treatment or community service or probation, instead of prison sentence.
Are there any indications that President Obama will continue this pace of granting clemency and or commuting sentences between now and January 19?
I think so. As you just previously mentioned, the president issued commutations yesterday, and we at the Brennan Center are pushing for many more commutations before he leaves office. Obviously, the time is ticking away, but this is certainly something that President-elect Trump will not be able to reverse when he takes office in less than a month.
Now, there seems to be a divide within both parties. The Koch brothers have bankrolled policy research on prison reform over the past few years. At the same time, Jeff Sessions seems to be very strongly opposed. In the history of some of the laws you write about, the Rockefeller laws, well, he was a Republican, but then Bill Clinton signed laws that are still affecting the way people are being prosecuted in this country. So what's your sense today of where the parties stand and the possibility of this incoming Congress working something out?
So Donald Trump campaigned on a message that Washington is broken, and our bloated, wasteful, and unnecessarily harsh criminal justice system is certainly a prime example of that. Additionally, Republicans like Speaker Paul Ryan, Senators Mike Lee and John Cornyn, and others have strongly backed criminal justice reform at the federal level. And in the states, many of the efforts were led by conservative lawmakers. So we think certainly at the state level, we see the momentum towards criminal justice reform continuing. And we're hopeful that the Republicans and the Democrats will work together not to back down now that Trump will be president in just a few weeks. Their voices are crucial in explaining to the next administration why this problem needs to be fixed.
Cornell William Brooks, the CEO of the NAACP, writes in the foreword to the report, "The single greatest injustice that threatens our safety and hinders our progress, mass incarceration. People of color bear the brunt of our criminal justice system in disproportionate and devastating numbers. This is in part because racial disparities exist at all stages of the system, which relies on corrosive practices that harm people of color." And don't the numbers confirm that? An estimated 2.2 million people are locked inside jails and prisons, and African Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population, but 37% of the nation's prisoners. Are African Americans committing crimes disproportionately or being incarcerated disproportionately?
African Americans and Latinos are over-policed, over-prosecuted, and over-incarcerated. One very good example of that is if you look at the crack cocaine disparities, and those have been reduced a little bit, but not entirely. You know, white Americans tend to use powder cocaine versus urban, you know, Americans who live in the cities and urban areas tended to use and sell crack cocaine. And we've seen that the penalties for using and selling crack cocaine are much harsher. They used to be 100-to-1. Than for using and selling powder cocaine. And so that's one piece of evidence that really, I think, shows very clearly what racial disparities look like in this country. And you're absolutely right. The African Americans make up about 13% of the nationwide population, but almost 40% of the nation's prisoners. That's a pretty staggering statistic.
My guest is Lauren Brooke Eisen, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and lead researcher for a new report issued by the Brennan Center called Unnecessarily Incarcerated. So how do we get to this point where the United States, with only 5% of the world's population, has nearly 25% of the world's prisoners? That's higher than Iran, Zimbabwe's, and even Singapore, where you can be punished for chewing gum or not flushing a public toilet.
Mass incarceration is the greatest civil rights injustice of our time. That statistic that you just mentioned is pretty eye-popping. And mass incarceration doesn't exist because America is unsafe. Mass incarceration exists because our lawmakers created it. Responding to rising crime in the 1960s and 1970s, states and the federal government enacted a series of laws that dramatically increased sentences for many crimes. And they also created completely new crimes. Today, crime rates have plummeted, in fact, reaching levels not seen since the 1960s. Mass incarceration was not the cause, and in fact, 27 states in the last decade have reduced crime and incarceration. That indicates that we don't need these staggering prison populations to keep communities safe. Despite 27 states reducing crime and incarceration, a lot of states have also increased incarceration. So we really are living in societies that are much safer than existed decades ago. I mean, take New York City, for example. The murder rate has dropped. It was over 2,000 a year in the 1990s, and the murder rate is in the hundreds now. All of this reduction in crime really gives us a window and an opening to take a look at our prison populations and start to de-incarcerate and start to use these alternatives to incarceration, like community treatment, drug treatment, probation, community service, even GPS ankle monitoring. All of these are safer, much cheaper, and just make a lot more sense than incarceration.
We'll get into the cost in a little while, but I'm wondering about the situation here in New York State, where the Rockefeller laws were enacted in 1973. They were mostly involved drugs. And hasn't drug possession gone down as a result, or didn't we lock away all the bad guys?
Yeah, so in New York, in the early 1990s, New York was very unsafe. We had very high homicide rates. And before that, New York pioneered one of the earliest mandatory minimum drug laws in the country, called the Rockefeller drug laws. And
was there a perception at the time that some judges exercised too much discretion in their sentencing, so they had to be forced to give mandatory sentences?
Well, a couple of things happened at the time. There was this fear of crime, right? I mean, this was a time when crack cocaine was being sold in urban areas. The media was certainly writing a lot about crack cocaine and the drug war, and a lot of people were scared, and policymakers took that opportunity, New York being one of the first states to create these mandatory minimum drug laws. New York created the Rockefeller drug laws in the 1970s, and in fact, the legislation created these mandatory minimum sentences of 15 years. That's a very long sentence for possession of 4 ounces of narcotics.
That's marijuana.
Well, narcotics. It wasn't, could be cocaine or other drugs, heroin. Ironically, the punishment was the same as a sentence for committing second-degree murder.
Now, go
ahead.
New
York was one of a number of states that started to enact these mandatory minimum drug laws.
We are now going through an opioid explosion, and actually I think that New York has just... I just heard New York has the highest death rate from overdoses this last year for many, many years in the past, since many years in the past. So are we just focusing on different drugs now?
Well, we have learned a lot since the 1970s, and I think it's very important that the research studying the interventions that we can use as a society to provide drug treatment, very targeted, mental health treatment, drug treatment, getting at the root causes of why someone may commit a crime in the first place is very important. In the 1960s and the 1970s, we just didn't know as much as we do now about how to treat people who have addictions to drugs, who may suffer from mental health illnesses. And we know a lot about treating people in the community. We know a lot about how people can, safely re-enter their communities if they have served time in prison. And it's really important. And if you look at Vermont, Vermont is really facing their heroin and opiate epidemic, not through incarceration, but they're battling it through drug treatment and mental health treatment. And I think Vermont is a model state and one that a lot of states should look at when we think about what the right intervention is. The right intervention is not time behind bars where people are not getting the drug and mental health treatment and the rehabilitative treatment that they need. There's very little rehabilitation and treatment in prison, and that's very important.
And aren't prisons, penitentiaries, the very word suggests a place where people repent and also learn, I guess, are prepared to go out and live more productive lives than they had in the past. Why aren't we seeing more rehabilitation programs in the universities? Is it a matter of money?
You mean in prison? Or
yeah, in the prisons. I've had listeners complain that we were sending people to prison and they had better gyms than were available in their neighborhood.
There's very little rehabilitative programming in prison. In fact, some of the best programs have wait lists. Prisons are warehousing human beings. Some prisons have good programming, but they're the rare ones. Most prisons really don't have the kind of targeted programming and interventions that actually targets the drivers of why someone may commit a crime in the first place. And we have learned a lot through research about how to target and how to intervene in a way that works in the community by providing drug treatment, mental health treatment. And it's a lot cheaper than providing it in prison as well. I'm sure you're very familiar with the statistics. It could cost $30,000 to $50,000 a year to send someone to prison for 1 year. That's more than it costs to go to Harvard.
My guest is Lauren Brooke Eisen, Senior Counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program and leads researcher for a report that was just issued called Unnecessarily Incarcerated. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're talking about a new report by the Brennan Center for Justice called Unnecessarily Incarcerated, with its lead researcher, Lauren Brooke Eisen. And we mentioned the Rockefeller Laws, also very popular. I think it started in California, but spread around the country, of the three strikes and you're out laws. How many states have adopted it?
So three strikes and you're out laws are another form of mandatory minimums. And what they are is they punish someone who's committed a crime, a third offense. And the reason that those laws are considered so draconian, so harsh, is because the third crime, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be a violent crime, right? And so there are a lot of stories about, you know, people in California who, you know, might have stolen some videotapes from a video store and received extremely long prison sentences because it was their third offense. And you know, that gets to the heart of why we wrote this report. We wrote this report because punishment doesn't always fit the crime, especially today with such harsh draconian sentences, such long prison sentences. And so our report also looks at which prison sentences can actually be reduced in terms of length of stays. And we looked at some of the more serious crimes, such as aggravated assault. And we determined that for 58% of the prison population that is serving, you know, some of the more serious crimes, their sentences could be safely reduced, likely by as much as 25%, because length of stays have increased so much. And, you know, the idea behind this report is also to look at proportionality. And sentences today are very disproportionate to the crime that's committed.
So the three strikes and your outlaws are addressing recidivism, which is one of the things that should be considered when we're sentencing. People are more likely to reoffend if they have already committed crimes in the past. But you're saying that we don't take into account the seriousness of that third offense or the victim impact or the intent of the criminal act?
Exactly. So our proposed sentences look at four factors. We examine seriousness. You know, murder, for instance, should be treated as a far graver crime than, let's say, writing a bad check. We looked at victim impact. We looked at intent, and we looked at recidivism. What we also looked at was decades of research indicating that prison in very many cases can also be what's called criminogenic. And what that means is that for a huge portion of lower-level offenders, those who may commit nonviolent crimes that might be their first time behind bars, prison can actually increase recidivism rates because they could be housed with someone who's more violent, who might have been in and out of prison for decades. In addition to the fact that...
You call it a criminogenic effect.
Yes, criminogenic. And you know, building on that, when prisoners are released from prison, many of them are released with, you know, I'm sure you've heard this phrase, you know, $5 and a bus ticket. They're not always released with services and even the medication that they may need. And some of them aren't even released with identification cards. There are a million collateral consequences that prevent them from getting help, public housing and jobs. And that the treatment that they need. And so we took all of this research into consideration, and our findings indicate that for about 212,000 people serving time in state and federal prison today, that they could be safely released within the next year, that they have already served a sufficiently long prison sentence.
It's also been pointed out that older prisoners are less likely to commit a crime once they're released, even if the crime they committed initially was a capital offense?
Yes. So there is a lot of evidence that people commit crime at a much younger age, so in their late teens and their early 20s. As people get older in general, you know, the evidence indicates that they will commit less and less crimes. And what we're doing with these very long sentences is we're simply warehousing people behind bars who don't need to be there, who are very little public safety risk. And a lot of these older inmates they are very expensive to incarcerate because they may need a lot of medical treatment, and they're not dangerous.
The federal crime bill became an issue during the last election campaign. Many African Americans told Hillary Clinton how upset they were and forced her to defend it and some of the things that she had said at the time it was enacted. Were the racial inequalities caused by that policy intentional or inadvertent side effects?
So the 1994 crime bill provided federal funding to states that increased their length of stays, increased sentences for violent people who had committed violent crimes. And what that bill did is it actually paid states to build prisons. And that certainly resulted in increased racial disparities, but you know, there's no evidence at all that that was intentional. And in a lot of these policies, you know, when you look back in hindsight, you realize what those resultant racial disparities were. You know, but at the time, people didn't have all of the evidence they had about how to treat the drivers of why someone may commit a crime in the first place. But we really wrote this report because today, in 2016, we know that prison's not working. We know that recidivism rates are almost 50%. Almost 75% in some states. You know, a country that spends so much money warehousing people behind bars with recidivism rates so high really needs to rethink what we are doing in terms of incarceration.
Now, recently, New York Times journalist Michael Weinrip and Michael Schwartz came on our show to talk about a report that they had published in the Times about racial bias in some New York State prisons, which I guess is not confined to New York. The consequence of that bias can result in fewer probation opportunities, harsher treatment while in prison, and then problems readjusting once someone is released, at least according to their findings.
So there have been some recent findings indicating that there are immense racial disparities in terms of how people are treated once they're confined, once they're incarcerated, if they're on probation or parole. And, you know, it's really important that we look at our incarceration policies from, you know, from arrest to incarceration to reentry. You know, these aren't problems that are necessarily compartmentalized in probation or in prison, right? You know, this is a problem with our criminal justice system. It's time that we take a step back and really rethink, you know, why we use prison, why we send someone behind bars in the first place, you know, why someone needs some sort of supervision, whether in the community or behind bars.
I'm speaking with Lauren Brooke Eisen, who is senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You found that, and you mentioned this earlier, over the last decade, 27 states have reduced both imprisonment and crime together. From 1999 to 2012, New Jersey and New York reduced their prison populations by about 30%, while crime fell faster than it did nationally. Do we know why?
We know that a lot of states in this country, Kentucky, South Carolina, New York, have started to look at their criminal justice policies and rethink how many people go to prison and for how long. And the impetus behind a lot of this thinking is that these states simply cannot afford to incarcerate so many of their citizens. It's just too expensive. And some states, California has had to reduce its prison population because of court order. And some states have, decided to look at what they're doing because they want to reduce recidivism rates. They're just looking at public safety. Some states have been forced to do this because they simply can't afford to incarcerate so many people.
It was interesting to look at whether they're red states or blue states, and it cuts across both. Texas decreased its imprisonment and crime by more than 20%.
Absolutely, and you know, New York has been a part of that as one of those states. And it's really important to look at this evidence because a lot of people will say, well, crime is down, but incarceration's up, right? But it's not that simple. You really need to look at the number of states that have reduced incarceration tremendously while also seeing huge drops in crime.
The Rockefeller laws were repealed in 2009. Haven't there been efforts to alter sentencing guidelines in other states as well?
There have been, and a lot of states have eliminated mandatory minimums for certain crimes. So Massachusetts right now is looking at reducing some of its mandatory minimums for drug crimes. Recently, Rhode Island reduced mandatory minimums for drug crimes and some other crimes. South Carolina has also made significant strides in changing a lot of its sentencing laws. And in fact, you know, South Carolina has reduced crime and incarceration, and in fact, so much so that they were able to close two prisons recently.
And marijuana has become legal in a number of states, some totally legal, some medical marijuana. But are there still people in prison for selling marijuana in the past, despite the changes in laws?
There are some people in state prison who are there for selling marijuana. That's certainly not the biggest chunk of people who are there for drug possession. And what happens in some cases is, you know, the law is complicated and the data is sometimes complicated. And in some situations, you know, someone may have been arrested for a much higher level crime. And because almost over 95% of crimes are actually pled out, they don't go to trial. You know, someone may take a plea for, let's say, marijuana possession in lieu of going to prison for a more serious crime. So there's certainly some people who may be in prison for those crimes as well.
Do you believe that mandatory sentencing laws should be eliminated and replaced with broad judicial discretion?
You know, the report looks at mandatory minimums, and certainly, you know, there needs to be a return of some discretion. You know, judges certainly shouldn't have their hands tied. And our report makes the recommendations that for most of the lower-level offenses that people commit in this country, that an alternative to incarceration should really be the default sanction, but barring exceptional circumstances. I mean, you're talking about a lot of people, a lot of crimes, some very complex situations. But the default, you know, our recommendation in this report is that the default sentence for most lower level of crimes should really be an alternative to incarceration, and that judges should have some discretion as well.
But isn't there an argument that broad judicial discretion could potentially exacerbate racial disparities in sentencing? I'm thinking about the case that disturbed many people when a California judge gave a light sentence to a Stanford swimmer who is white and privileged. He's actually already been released after serving half of his six-month sentence for the sexual assault of an unconscious woman. Many people pointed out that if he had been black or Hispanic, it's likely that he would have been given a much harsher sentence.
Well, it's an interesting question. And again, our recommendations for these default sanctions that are not incarceration are for these lower-level crimes. So our report you know, focuses on that, and then our report focuses on reducing the time served for some of the more serious crimes. You know, but that crime is not necessarily, you know, that's not in the lower level crime category.
Your research was reviewed by sentencing experts, John Gleason, former U.S. District Judge, Eastern District of New York, and Carol Steiker, the Henry J. Friendly Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Did they agree with your conclusions?
They reviewed our report, you know, looking at the report, making sure you know, they gave us some wonderful feedback and insights as to the criminal justice system and their experiences with the criminal justice system. So we were thrilled to have their insights and wisdom, as we wrote this report and as we finalized its findings.
A listener, Evelyn on Twitter, asks, how do citizens stop mass incarceration without protests and boycotts? What could we do?
There are many things that just regular citizens can do. They can elect prosecutors who they think will be fair-minded and will use their prosecutorial discretion to suggest alternatives to incarceration for a whole host of lower-level crimes.
Do prosecutors actually run campaigns with that kind of promise?
Absolutely.
Don't they say, I'm going to be tough on crime?
Well, in the past, it's always been very difficult for state, federal, local policymakers, district attorneys, to win office if they appeared soft on crime. Look at when Bill Clinton was running for president, he flew back down to Arkansas to oversee, a death penalty situation. And, we've seen in the past, it's been very, very difficult for Democrats and Republicans to win higher office, win office at all, if they're seen as soft on crime. But we're starting to see that change. We've certainly seen President Obama, he was the first president to ever visit a federal prison. He has been granting clemency requests. We're starting to see that in a lot of states, and we've seen a lot of district attorneys recently win office who really are looking at fairness, efficiency, and justice. And, the Brennan Center for Justice has a group called Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. And a lot of those police chiefs and prosecutors are working very hard in their home communities to work to implement alternatives to incarceration and ensure, drug treatment and mental health treatment is being used in lieu of incarceration.
My guest has been Lauren Brooke Eisen, Senior Counsel for the Brennan Center's Justice Program. They have just issued a new report that she was the lead researcher on called Unnecessarily Incarcerated. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.